Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And as always, along with your calls, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about what effect a sports team has on your driving. Whether they win, whether they lose, do you think it affects how you're driving after a game?
I have an opinion, but I'll give it later.
Absolutely. You're going to have to stay tuned, Tom. And we're going to talk about low-income mothers who are under stress may overfeed their babies.
What's our recipe to overfeed those babies?
Thai beef. It's delicious. It's a yummy recipe, but I don't think the Thai beef is exactly what you're going to put in a baby bottle.
This recipe from guest chef Allison Fishman. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, let's welcome in our first caller, a listener with us now in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hey, Zorba. Tom, how are you today?
Fine. How can we help you?
I have had ringing in my ears for about 28 years, and I've gone through just about every logical and illogical way of trying to solve it, and just didn't know if you had any ideas.
Well, tell us about the logical and illogical things you've tried.
All right. So from the logical, you know, I had a fever when I was 12, and that kind of spurred the whole ringing. And so went through some tests, doctors, and they said there's really nothing to do. And so at that point, I let it shelf for about 20 years, didn't think about it too much. And then over the last few years, I've been trying to tackle this problem again through acupuncture, also energy work, kinesiology, diet, and just recently hypnotism, but still no prevail.
What does energy work mean?
Energy work, it's when you find somebody who kind of finds the balance, kind of the chi or the yin-yang, whatever energy force you believe within yourself, and you kind of figure out, is there some blocking, and they just kind of test your energy and then give you some natural remedies to try to combat it.
Did you, the energy work, did that do anything for you?
You know, not for this, for other things it's helped, but specifically even in my family, my daughter has really bad nasal drip, and it's cleared it right up.
I've heard of chi. I have a good friend in New York, Western New York, Binghamton, New York, who actually engages in energy work. He's a family doc like I am, and said he actually uses it with different patients, and for some people can be quite useful. And we all know that we direct our energies in different ways during the day, and this is sort of a self-healing. So it was at 12 years of age, you had a high fever, you developed ringing, and so must have been pretty significant at 12. I assume any loss of hearing at the same time? At all?
No loss of hearing. They tested everything. It was just this
the
they said if you've got a pitch, right. And some people think it could be psychological. I don't know.
Well, first of all, there's no way to measure ringing in the ears. Ringing in the ears often comes. It can come with a high fever. I mean, that's the way it starts. It quite often is associated with some hearing loss. In other words, that's the most common way it is. You have ringing in the ears from loud noises, which obviously didn't happen. It was a fever in your case, and then often you have the ringing accompanied by this inability to sort of hear. And so in your case, it didn't happen. And you have pretty much tried the gamut of everything. And the answer is, as of now, we have no cure for ringing in the ears or tinnitus. I mean, I'm sure it's there and you attend to it. And, the treatment for tinnitus, and if you go on the web, and if you talk to anyone who has it, there are a million treatments, are basically to try to not hear it by listening to other sounds, which is the most common thing. Some people, if they're bothered, often they're bothered before they go to sleep, what they do is they put on the radio, they put on white noise from the radio, or they actually will put on a DVD, CD, iPod, which will play, something very pleasant, such as the sound of wind and the trees or something else.
Wave machine or something.
Wave machine. And that's, once again, to sort of get your brain to something else. And other people say, well, I really don't need it. I'll just kind of ignore it. And they go to sleep because they're fast sleepers. During the day, when you're listening to other things, people often are not bothered unless they're quiet in a room working on a computer or something else, in which case they often put on something in the background. That's the best treatment. I don't think you're ever going to cure this. I think this is a lifetime thing you have. I don't think it's psychological. I think it's really there, but sometimes you attend to it and sometimes you don't. And like you said, you've noticed you attend to it sometimes more than others, and figuring out how to not attend to it is your goal, and I think you've got some tools there. So good luck. I have nothing magic for you. Sorry.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
We appreciate the call. Thank you so much. 800-462-7413, toll-free. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Jacksonville, Florida. Hello.
Hi.
What's up?
I have an essential tremor in my right hand, and I think I've had it pretty much in my childhood because I remember in ballet class the teacher telling me to stop shaking, and I couldn't. But that's the only memory of it in my childhood, and then growing up it got worse in my 20s and 30s. So it's kind of hard to write until it forms out, and I did take Inderol for a time, mm-hmm. but that made me boring. So
that
I didn't
made
want to
you
take
boring.
Yes.
Wait a minute, what do you mean it made you boring? You mean people said, "My
blah.
Gosh, we can't talk to her; she's so boring."
It made me a little blah, and I thought, "Well, I'd just rather have the tremor than be blah."
You'd rather have the tremor. What did it do for your tremor, by the way?
I don't think it did much for my tremor.
Oh, okay. You know, essential tremor is a terrible, terrible term because it's not essential to anything. I mean, that's the term
right.
we use. Also, the other term is benign tremor. Well, it's not benign when you have it. It's benign when somebody else has it. And, you know, and but that's the term, benign essential tremor or essential tremor. And we all have it to some extent. If you hold out our, you know, your hand, you know, forget, you know, to a very small extent, some of us have it. Some of us have it more. When people speak, if they have to get up and they speak publicly and sometimes they're a little nervous and you hear a little trill in their voice, mm-hmm. that is the normal tremor affecting their vocal cords. And
right.
one of the treatments for tremor that actually is quite effective is alcohol. And so people take alcohol.
Oh, that's exciting.
So I would recommend booze.
A doctor told me once a little red wine will help.
A little red wine will help, but careful, it might stain. So maybe you'll have to use white wine. But you can't go along having a shot of Jack Daniels, you know, in the morning when you get up, or a shot of rum. I want to get back to the beta blocker for a minute. There's several different kinds of beta blockers. Inderol is one kind and one type called non-selective. Atenolol, A-T-E-N-O-L-O-L, is another kind. It's partially – it's a different selectivity than Inderol, another generic. There's another beta blocker called Bistolic, which is name brand B-Y-S-T-O-L-I-C. They all work a little bit differently. And what I would recommend, if you gave a trial for beta blockers – and by the way, the comment – that you were blah is not an unusual comment, but you may have been on too high a dose. I would try a variety of other beta blockers to see if there's one beta blocker that works for you. And I think that's far preferable than drinking booze.
Drinking booze or maybe a little wine.
Ah, there you go. Okay. Take care. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you so much. I love your show.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. 1-800-462-7413. Interesting research, Zorba, from North Carolina State University on sports fans and driving.
Yes, some very interesting research. So here it is, your sports fan. They're looking at whether or not the fans win and lose, and they look back into car accidents. You know, another number of people were having significant car accidents because people often listen to sports on the radio.
And get excited.
And so they looked at whether they won, whether they lost, to see if there was any correlation. And then they looked at the nail biters, you know, the ones that are really close. It's, you know, basketball and it's 2 points here and it's two points there.
Overtime game or 77-76.
All of the other stuff. And lo and behold, when they were nail biter games where they won, they were more likely to have car crashes.
When they won.
Yeah. Versus nail-biter games where they lost. Hmm. In other words, when they won a game and it was a nail-biter game, obviously people were not paying attention to what was in front of them or on the side of them in the traffic. And they were going, ooh, high-fiving each other in the
car.
And
apparently this was significant, not just...
Oh, yes. No, no. This was a statistically significant incident. There were more car fatalities. We're talking about fatal car accidents when there was a game that was really, really close where they won versus
you
when
mentioned
it was a
earlier counterintuitive. You'd think if you lost the game, you'd be more likely.
Totally. Or, you know, if it's a blowout loss game, people would be upset and they would be angry and they wouldn't pay attention. Not at all. So my recommendation is if it's a really close game and you're driving, maybe you should shut off the radio, right?
You can't do that. You can't shut off the radio if it's a close game.
Shut off the radio. It's safe for your driving. Can you imagine if you told people to do that? What would they do?
Yeah. But after the game, maybe you could find a place and pull over and, you know, get it out of your system a little bit. You know, celebrate parked in a either a driveway or...
That's right. Yeah. If you're going to celebrate...
Woo, 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 woo. And then after you're done, get back in the car and drive some.
It's amazing what affects our ability to drive. Just amazing.
Yeah, just be careful when you're driving after your team wins a close game.
That's right. If they lose... It doesn't matter.
Yep. 800-462-7413, toll free. That's 1-800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to Springfield, Illinois now. Hi.
Hi.
What's
How are
up? You? Fine. What's up?
Yeah, I'm 49 years old, and I've been taking antidepressants for about 15 years, which has really, really helped me. My question is kind of a question and a theory. As I've gotten older, of course, it's easier to gain weight, and as I've been on these SSRIs, I find it more and more difficult to lose weight when I gain it. So I've done a little experiment lately and really watched my calories and realized that, you know, even when I don't eat more, it's still very, very difficult to get my weight down.
Yeah.
And it struck me that possibly what's going on is not that I eat more, because I don't think I do, but that I move less.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I think that is because after I started taking SSRIs, I noticed that for the first time I was really calm. I didn't have a lot of racing thoughts. And I wondered if that translated into less small movements.
Probably there are a couple of things that are going on, and you're probably correct. But there's another issue. So you've been on SSRIs for 15 years, mm-hmm. but you've gained weight over this 15-year period.
Yes.
Okay, so the first thing to note that's really important is it's not that you took the SSRI and then gained the 20 pounds. In other words, you've had a change in behavior over 15 years. There are a few things going on here. We lose about 1% of our muscle mass every year, so you don't have the same muscles that you had 15 years ago. You may not notice a difference, but over time, you know, you can be the same weight at the age of 50 than you were at 25, but if you look at yourself in the mirror, you've got more sags at 50 and you don't have the muscle strength that you have. So you've lost some muscle mass over the 15 years. That's number one. Thermogenesis theory, this idea of small movements, is exactly right on it. And this is it's been measured numerous times where people who are thin do a lot of smaller movements when we look at movements in a chair, out of a chair, just with their arms and legs. And some estimates are they may do 250 to 300 calories more per day with these movements. And remember, you know, 300 calories a day can be significant. So my recommendation, I've got a couple recommendations for you. Number one, look at what you're eating. Go to a good website. There's a good website that I called LoseIt, LoseIt.com. And we'll attach it on our website, zorbapastor.org. So I'll put that on our website so you can look at it. It's just a website that it's an easy way to keep track of your calories and look at the foods you're eating. Read the labels and figure out how to get rid of 250 calories. That's number one. You're eating too much. That's not for your body. Number two, look at how you can move more, because you probably are moving less. But also over 15 years, you're moving less because you're 15 years older. So you did a lot of other movement when you were younger. And figure out how not to, whatever you're doing during the day, how to get up and start to move around and add activity during day. You know, maybe it's getting up to getting a drink of water, or maybe it's moving from one computer to the other. I'm not sure what it is. But figure out how to add another 100 calories or 200 calories to your daily movement.
Yeah, I think maybe wearing a pedometer, that 10,000 steps a day thing.
Excellent. The average person in America gets 2,500 steps, and if you can move that up to 10,000 steps a day, you're golden. Well, that is great. And then once again, you got to look at the calories.
We found on a recent show, get a dog. Do you have a dog?
That's right. That's right. Get a dog.
No, I have a cat.
Oh, no. Get rid of the cat. Get a dog. And walk the dog.
I could take my cat for a walk, but that would be kind of strange looking at it.
If you went down the street walking your cat, yes, people would look at you.
I'd say get rid of the cat anyway, whether you need the exercise.
Thank you, Tom, who is not a cat lover. Cats are great. Bad, bad, Tom. Thank you so much for your call.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. Zorba, before we get to our break, it's time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. On a past show, you were chatting about Linus Pauling and said that he was the only person to win two Nobel Prizes in two different fields. Well, as usual, our listeners are on top of it and quickly filled our inbox to set the record straight. Fan of the show, Michael, sums things up well, writing, "I hate to do this, but I am a confirmed insufferable pedant, so I feel I have to send in a small correction to the show. Linus Pauling was not the only person to have won two Nobel Prizes. Marie Curie was the only other person to win two prizes in different fields, physics in 1903 and chemistry in 1911. Two other people won prizes in the same field twice, John Bardeen, physics in 1956 and 1972, and Frederick Sanger, chemistry in 1958 and 1980. However, Pauling was the only person who won two unshared Nobel Prizes.
You know, I love the pedants in this world. I love the people with OCD in this world. I love the people who pay attention to detail because they always teach me something. And yes, I stand corrected. You are correct. I am incorrect. And Madame Curie, I knew her well.
Yeah. Interesting stuff, I think.
It's very interesting.
If you should find yourself on that rare occasion differing with the good doc, send your rebuttal for our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, and we have a guest chef with that recipe. Lots more of your questions. We have some more interesting research to talk over. And, of course, our medical myth buster. Stick around here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our phone number, 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, it is my pleasure to introduce our guest, Chef Allison Fishman. In addition to co-hosting Cook Yourself Thin on the Lifestyle Channel, Allison is the author of the cookbook, You Can Trust a Skinny Cook, 140 Recipes That Love You Back. Allison's cookbook is filled with low-calorie dishes that are easy and fun to make, with a heaping side order of kitchen tips to help you cut prep time and calories from your meals without jeopardizing taste. So, without further ado, here's a fantastic recipe from her book for Thai beef. Allison, hi.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be on your show.
Oh, it's really great to have you. So you're co-host of Lifetime's Cook Yourself Thin.
Yes.
How long have you been doing that?
How long have I been cooking myself thin? It's been a long time. The show came out in 2009, but I actually went to culinary school in 2001 after about 10 years working corporate. I worked corporate and put on some weight and was a real stranger to my kitchen. And I said, I think I'm not the only one in this situation. So
gotcha.
I went to culinary school to help people get back into the home kitchens and take control of their health.
A real stranger to your kitchen.
Now, how does a recipe love you back? What do you mean?
You know, it's funny. I was just reading up on you guys, since this is the first time that we're meeting. And I was reading in your bios that you both love chocolate.
Yes.
And you love food like that. Now, the question is, how do we make that chocolate love us back? We know chocolate is filled with antioxidants. So it's not that we can't have the food, but it's that we need to have the food in a different way, in a different portion, in a different amount.
Oh, you mean love you back like won't make us fat, right?
Won't make you fat, won't make you unhappy, won't make you feel sluggish.
Got it.
It's interesting. There are a few things when I think about this that come up. In our small town, we have a Swiss chocolatier where I'm a family doc, and I always have chocolate with me from him because it's really good chocolate.
Exactly.
And then if you look at Michael Pollan, who wrote a number of books in defense of food and Botany of Desire, and I've heard him numerous times, and he said, eat what you like in the right amounts. You know, eat things that are good in the right amounts, and that's the problem is we have all these empty
this
calories.
This is fun, but we got to get the time.
Yes. We do. Okay, so we're going to look at Thai beef. So how did you come up with this recipe?
So I have a cooking school where I actually go to people's homes. My instructors and I go to people's homes and show them how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
We're invited into people's kitchens, which is great because sometimes if you take a class at a culinary school, you'll say, well, this is fancy with the fancy food and fancy equipment, but I won't be able to do it at home. We took the myth right out of that, and this is one of my students' favorite recipes. It's a Thai dish, right? So sometimes people think, oh, am I going to need weird ingredients? Am I going to have to go to a special grocery store? Absolutely not. You're using cilantro, lime juice, chilies, all things that you can usually find at the grocery store, brown sugar, and then you're doing a traditional Thai preparation of caramelizing the onions, right? Mm-hmm. So you get deep, rich, sweet flavor from the onions, and then put on top of it this very vivid, you know, sweet, sour sauce, mm-hmm. and combine it with the beef.
Cool.
Now, since there's so much sauce, I'm using a very lean cut of beef. I'm using a flank steak or a London broil so that you can you don't need that rich, you know, ribeye flavor. You don't need that fatty cut of meat because this dish is more about the sauce.
So let's go on. And let's start. I have a question for you. You can do this probably with pork or with chicken. You might even be able to even do this with tofu, I would think, if you wanted to.
That is a wonderful preparation. I do have some vegetarian clients that have asked. Again, so this dish is about the sauce. If you want to have a fattier cut of meat, I've got a recipe in this book with skirt steak, right? Skirt steak is pretty rich and pretty fatty. So what do I do with that? I partner it with a chimichurri sauce, which is largely, you know, cilantro and parsley and vinegar, right? That acid, that vinegar is going to cut through the richness of the fattier cut of steak. And, of course, you're going to have that cut of steak in a much smaller portion. So if you go for the leaner option, you can have a bigger portion. Absolutely. Use your pork. Use your chicken. For sure use your tofu.
Great. It sounds great.
Throw the dog a piece of meat.
Mailman just came by. Sorry about that, guys.
No, not at all. We're dog people, so immediately our ears are going right to the dog.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we start out with 1.5 pounds of either flank steak, top round, or London broil.
Mm-hmm.
1 teaspoon of kosher salt.
Mm-hmm.
A tablespoonful of a vegetable oil, any kind of vegetable oil that people have in the house. 2 large onions halved and sliced into 1/3 thick half moons. So you're slicing them. Wouldn't make a difference, white onions, red onions, just whatever onions you have around?
Exactly, whatever you've got. I like red onions because I think they have a little more flavor and sweetness. Since we want to caramelize these onions, if you can pick a nice Vidalia or a Walla Walla, a sweet onion will help you get there faster.
Which sounds good. And then we're going to use 1/2 cup of low-sodium soy sauce and 1/2 cup of light brown sugar. The soy sauce issue is really good, I think. And I've switched to low-sodium, good brands of low-sodium soy sauce because we get too much salt, you know, in our diet.
Sure.
1/3 cup of fresh lime juice. I know it's important, and a lot of our listeners will probably realize it when they do. You can't get reconstituted lime juice. It does not taste the same.
Hear, hear.
You know, it just doesn't have that, whatever lime juice has for its umami, for that fullness, it doesn't have it. 2 tablespoons of Vietnamese or Thai fish sauce. So people can pretty much get this in most grocery stores in the Asian section, you think?
I know the brand Roland makes it. Also, when I was making this cookbook, I found a great tip. If you don't have fish sauce is usually made from anchovies, get some anchovy paste.
Oh.
and go equal parts. So you could use, for this, I would use a tablespoon of that anchovy paste and a tablespoon of water.
Excellent.
Stir it together.
Excellent. So people may be able to do that. And I always find anchovy paste, which I use next to the tuna in the grocery store. Three serrano chilies or two jalapenos, thinly sliced. I love it. Depending on the desired heat. Yes, yes. Two large garlic cloves minced. Then one cup of freshly chopped basil leaves, lightly packed, and another cup of freshly chopped cilantro leaves, lightly packed. Cilantro is always interesting because some people will put it in and some people won't.
That's right.
You know, and that's where...
You can double the basil if you don't want the cilantro.
Exactly. And that would be good. So we would double the basil. Okay, so let's make it. Turn the broiler on. Place a heavy oven-proof skillet, preferably cast iron. I've got a cast iron in my house. 6 inches from the broiler element. Then heat the skillet for about 10 minutes, then season the flank steak or London broil or top broiler chicken, whichever one you're using, rubbing it into the meat. Carefully remove the skillet from the oven. Be careful because it's really hot. Place it on the stovetop and place the meat in the skillet, and it's going to sizzle. And then return that skillet to its spot under the broiler and cook it until the meat is medium rare, and that's going to be about 10 minutes. How thick is the London broil or top broiler flank steak when you get it?
It's about an inch and a half thick, and I have to tell you, I adore this method because you're actually heating the pan while you're preheating the broiler, right?
Yeah,
you're heating the oven
actually,
and the pan.
It's actually
a great
idea.
So when you put the steak in, it's cooking from the bottom and the top at the same time. You cook it more efficiently.
Yeah, I never really thought about it, but it's great because otherwise the bottom is really, especially in the broiler, it's not doing anything. It's just
absolutely
sitting there.
Absolutely not.
You know, absolutely not. So remove the skillet from the broiler, transfer the meat to a plate, and cover with aluminum foil. Let it rest for about 10 minutes so the juices go back. Then heat the oil in a large skillet over medium heat. Add the onions and onions and leave them sweat until they're soft and beginning to caramelize. That's about 20 minutes. Stir in the soy sauce, brown sugar, lime juice, fish sauce, chilies, and garlic. Bring it to a simmer and cook it gently over medium heat until it's reduced by half. It's going to be somewhere around 5 to 10 minutes. Then remove the sauce from the heat. Stir in the basil and cilantro, if you like the cilantro, which I do. Taste to ensure that the sauce is sweet, sour, salty, and spicy. How wonderful is that? Adjust the seasoning as needed for each flavor if you need to. Then cut the steak into thin slices against the grain. Toss with the sauce and serve.
Did you
I
say
love it.
Add the onions and sweat?
Well, they sweat. They kind of sweat as they, well, you know, they kind of sweat. You look at the onions and kind of the water is going out of the onions. Yeah, they sweat.
They sure do. And they actually shrink to less than half their size.
Yeah, they shrink. You know, Tom, every time you cook in the kitchen, you put a pot of onions on the stove and they sweat and go down. It's the moisture. You're going out of
I'd have to find the stove first.
But they do sweat, and that's kind of what they're that's kind of what they're called. I love the recipe. 262 calories for a serving. That's of course really important, and it's this delicious taste. It sounds great, and I looked through the cookbook. You can trust a skinny cook. I think it's a great cookbook. I just love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Allison.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
You too. And to get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Allison's cookbook, you can trust a skinny cook. And where to get it, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor recipes on ZorbaPastor.org. And you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
We're fine. How can we help you?
Yes, I have been diagnosed with trigeminal neuralgia, and I'm taking the medication Lyrica, and the actual side effects of the medication seem to be making me feel worse than the actual pain. I was wondering if, since this is used for epilepsy and things like that, if it's just something that it will take a long time to get used to it, or if I should just move on and try something else.
Yeah, before you answer, Zorba, help us out with that diagnosis that you mentioned.
Well, trigeminal neuralgia, the trigeminal nerve in the face, is the nerve, among other things, you can experience pain, this tremendous pain. When you've got a toothache, it's the trigeminal nerve. Your eye hurts you, it's the trigeminal nerve. And sometimes the nerve just springs up on itself and basically starts to be painful. And people describe it as an awful, awful pain. And the treatment for it that has really been very successful over the years are to use anti-epileptic drugs. The previous drug that was used is a drug called Tegretol, very commonly used drug, made a huge difference. I mean, morphine doesn't work, opioids don't work. But anti-epileptic drugs really can make a difference in trigeminal neuralgia. And Lyrica is a very good drug. You're having, what sort of side effects are you having?
The worst one is nausea. And I feel like I'm hungry, but if I eat, then I feel even worse, and I get headaches. Lately, I was starting to get blurry vision, and just overall, and night,
okay,
it's really bad when I went to bed.
And one more question, how much are you on?
I started with 50 milligrams. 3 times a day, and then I went to 75 3 times a day.
Okay, I've got some advice. First of all, the thing with all anti-epileptic drugs like Lyrica and a number of other drugs is you've got to give it some time to work and then see if you can tolerate the side effects. Quite often, after 3 or 4 weeks, people will get used to the side effects, but some people don't, but a lot of people do. So I would certainly hang in there with any drug change for about 3 to 4 weeks. If that doesn't work, I'd lower the drug, see what that would do, because sometimes it's a dosage issue. If that doesn't work, I would talk to the neurologist or internist or family doc who put you on it, and I would try another anti-epileptic drug. Because even though one may have side effects, the other one may not. So in other words, you might end up tolerating a different drug. Don't give up the ship because these drugs work.
Okay, thank you so much.
We appreciate the call. At 1-800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. A caller in El Paso, Texas now, Zorba. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
My girlfriend has, I don't know what's wrong with her. She, for some reason, she always feels that she's really tired and she's always sleepy. And this has been on for quite a while now, for a few years actually, and usually what I try to do is to tell her and try to make her do some exercise, you know, get all the endorphins moving and the body moving so you can feel a little better, but she's usually really exhausted, and we both have two jobs, so I don't know, we were talking about supplements or changes in habits and sleeping time or something like that, but I don't know exactly what we could use to help her feel better.
Did you? You didn't say you both have two jobs, did you?
Yes, we both do.
Well, isn't that pretty? Isn't it obvious why she's tired all the time?
Yeah. So you know, college students with the economy and everything else.
Oh yes. I fully relate to it. I do have a couple of suggestions. First of all, you know, you need the two jobs because you've got to do what you've got to do. For survival.
That's tough.
One of the things you want to do that you can manipulate right away, even though it's hard and it takes a little bit of sort of rigor and habit, is to look at your sleep and try to get more sleep. Because often if you've got two jobs, you're not getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep, you know, in the bed, relaxing. It just is hard with two jobs to get that. And that's the first thing people sort of don't even think about with energy. So first of all, I'd look at the sleep habits. Look at the bed. Make sure that the bed is okay. It's dark in the room. You can go to sleep. The phone is off. And when you go to sleep, it's very important not to go to sleep in front of the TV or a computer. That disturbs REM sleep. You want to get deep sleep. So reading a book, reading a magazine, reading a newspaper is completely different from falling asleep in front of any electronic device. And there are very good studies that show that. So I'd hit the sleep first, even before I did the exercise. Say, how can we get 7 hours of sleep? Can we really do it? And it means shutting things off. Ending your day. That's number one. Number two, I would look at if she goes to the doctor, I'd look at her thyroid because she may be hypothyroid. She may have a low thyroid hormone. It does happen. 25-year-olds do have it. It's not that common. Not that rare, I guess I would say, but it's not totally uncommon. And it's a very simple blood test. And I would check the thyroid hormone to see if that's, you know, that's, you know, that's a, an, an effect in there. Then looking at a supplement point of view, a good multivitamin that's a house brand, CVS, Walgreens, Target, Walmart, a house brand multivitamin plus 2,000 milligrams or 2,000 international units of vitamin D is kind of what I call the baseline supplementation. And that's what I would recommend, you know, as a third thing. There are lots of things that can cause fatigue. We could spend a whole show on that. But once again, I'd look at sleep first, and then I'd look at the other things after that.
Okay. Okay, awesome.
Good. Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. Love the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call. I'm tired just listening to talking about two
Listen,
jobs.
I've worked 80 hours a week. I can relate. You've worked 80 hours a week, haven't you?
That's a good one. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox, see if we can help out Gloria in Spokane, Washington. Now, Gloria clearly sent this from her iPod because the autocorrect function has this email addressed to Dr. Zebra.
I love it.
But seriously, Gloria has a concern about her newborn baby who's suffering from nighttime nasal congestion. Gloria writes, "My one-month-old daughter, Jenny, has had significant nighttime nasal congestion. It resolves during the day, but the snorting, sputtering, and choking sounds that accompany the congestion are distressing. We have her sleeping in her bouncy chair because it gets much worse when she lays flat on her back. No one in my home is ill, and no one smokes. The bulb, syringe, and saline provide little relief. Any suggestions to help her breathe easier and sleep better?"
Oh, so tough, you know. Yeah. A young child and a bulb syringe to suck out the mucus helps a little bit, but they can't breathe through their mouth. You know, when we get congested, we breathe through our mouth. Moisturizing the air does make a difference. Humidifier, putting a humidifier in the room, ultrasonic humidification is sort of the best, and just putting in the room, you know, close to the baby can make a big difference. And that's what you do. You know, you suck out the nose and you humidify the air and hope for the best. And that's kind of how you handle it. Wish I had something else, but we know that we don't give medicines to little children anymore. That, you know, basically the FDA has called on the fact that these are not recommended for children under the age of 2. And so we've stopped giving them. And in fact, the studies show they didn't do very much at all. So humidify the air. And then bulbs are into the nose. And good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck, young parents.
And let us decongest your lifestyle problems. Just send them to Dr. Zebra in an email.
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some really interesting research to talk about. More of your calls coming up, too. And our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, interesting, Zorba, that low-income moms under stress may tend to overfeed their infants.
Right. It's an interesting study that was presented at the American Academy of Pediatrics meeting. And let me give a little bit of background. First of all, babies are fed formula, right? They're fed formula for the first year of life of one sort or another. And what they were looking at was adding cereal to the bottle, cereal being basically extra calories that you don't necessarily need. Now, there's a point at which you feed a baby cereal, but adding it to the bottle, the idea behind a lot of mothers is the thought is, well, if I feed the baby extra calories, they're more likely to sleep through the night.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And everyone wants their baby to sleep
right.
through the night.
Right.
If you're stressed, you want your baby to sleep through the night even more. You've got less reserve. And if you're a low income under stress, you have even less reserve. And
yeah.
they found that 24%, literally a quarter of the moms that they actually studied, put cereal in the bottles of their baby at night, which is discouraged. It's not considered to be a good, healthy habit when you're putting your child to sleep. And if a woman was depressed, mm-hmm. she was 15 times more likely to add cereal to yeah. the bottle than if the woman was not depressed.
Well, understanding that's not a good idea, does it work?
Studies have shown it really doesn't work, that babies wake up when they're going to wake up in the middle of the night. And how they only eat so much, then they stop eating, and some are hungry in 4 hours, some are hungry in 6 hours, and feeding them cereal doesn't work. You know, it's a myth that putting cereal in the bottle actually does anything. But what isn't a myth is that if we overfeed our children overall when they're younger, we may be actually encouraging them to have a lifetime of obesity. And that's not a myth. And overfeeding a child is a big issue.
Yeah, that was my next question. What's wrong with it? But you say maybe. Do we have any good research on whether this does or does not lead to obesity?
I don't think that. Well, first of all, there's some good data that seems to show now we're overfeeding our infants, our children, and our kids.
Right.
There is research on that.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
But whether or not to obesity as an adult.
Well, there's no doubt that obese children are more likely to become obese adults. There's no doubt
but
about
baby,
that.
But baby?
Well, that's the question. The research on infants that are less than 1 year of age is much, much spottier. That's a different issue. But when we look at this is, they just looked at bottles at nighttime. They didn't look at overfeeding babies during the daytime. In other words,
variable thrown in here.
Right. And if you're depressed and you're overfeeding your baby at night, you may be overfeeding your baby during the day, and you may be associating food with tender, loving care when you're depressed. And that's the issue. That's the broader issue. Yeah,
so the bottom line on this?
The bottom line is don't put cereal in the bottle with your baby. We need more research on basically feeding infants to make sure we're feeding them the right way. And if you're depressed and you need help, try to get it and don't overfeed your child.
800-462-7413, and a listener now, Zorba, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba.
What's up?
So a couple years ago, I was at an Ultimate Frisbee tournament. I play a lot of competitive Ultimate Frisbee, and I don't know if someone had mentioned it to me or if someone had pickles on the field. But what happened was my legs were cramping up, and I drank some pickle juice, and my legs stopped cramping in like 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, do you know of any reason why pickle juice would help with cramping or relax your muscles?
Well, before Zorba answers, are you 9 years old?
No.
Why are you doing throwing frisbees anymore?
Wait a minute, this is Ultimate Frisbee.
Well, I don't know what's Ultimate
you
Frisbee?
You know something? Tom has clearly been in the dark ages somewhere if he doesn't know about Ultimate Frisbee Ultimate Frisbee competition.
What is Ultimate Frisbee?
Well, it has as much movement as soccer. You're running all the time. You have 7 people on the field. You have to throw the disc to each other. You can't drop it. If you drop it, it's a turnover. And you have to catch the disc in the end zone. It's a lot of running.
Oh, sort of like football with frisbee.
It's soccer.
Yeah, except for football, you stop all the time.
Oh, yeah, soccer. Yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah, so and Tom, are you going to join a team, Tom?
Well, no.
No, that's the issue. Pickle juice and cramps. You know, this is kind of a very interesting thing. I've had a number of people who have sent me emails. Pickle juice is obviously a salty juice. I mean, it's got salt in it because pickles have a lot of salt. So there's a lot of sodium in there. I don't think the dill probably does much, but maybe the dill does. Maybe the dill does have a factor if it happens to be pickle juice and they're dill pickles. But I have people who swear that when they take pickle juice, they get rid of their cramps. And I'm not sure physiologically what happens, but I know that when you're running around, Ultimate Frisbee, you're sweating, you may be dehydrated, and maybe this burst of sodium is doing it. So you know what? If it works, stick with it.
I definitely will.
Yeah. How often do you play Ultimate Frisbee?
3 times a week or so. I'm actually helping coach a women's ultimate team for the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire.
Oh, cool. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Keep it up. It is a great sport. It's wonderful. We had a good friend, Annie Berry, who did ultimate frisbee for many, many years, and we used to go to tournaments, so I know what ultimate frisbee
is. Well, actually, don't write me or email me. I was just sort of kidding about the 9-year. I kind of knew what ultimate frisbee was.
No worries.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
800-462-7413. Our toll-free number is 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, it's that time in the show where we reveal our medical MythBuster. We have a listener myth today that comes to us from Paul in Appleton, Wisconsin. Paul is a student at the Wisconsin School for the Visually Handicapped and has a question about a vegetable that's coming into season right now. He writes, "Sometimes, as a part of our school lunches, they serve asparagus. I've heard that when you eat asparagus, it can make your urine smell funny. Is this true? And if so, why?"
Well, asparagus does make your urine smell funny if you can smell it. It's very interesting. There's kind of a controversy. The answer is yes. A lot of people,
well, anybody would know that who eats asparagus.
Half the population knows that, that your urine smells funny. My urine does not smell funny when I eat asparagus.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. Well, that's it. The question is whether or not it's really that some people actually produce the, you know, the funny smell, which is mercaptan, which is a sulfur-type compound, and mercaptan is what the compound is. The question is, do some people produce it and other people do not? Or is it a genetic issue, an autosomal gene, where some people can smell it and other people can't? The research is out. You know, we don't have enough people smelling other people's urine to answer that question.
I never knew that. I thought everybody's urine smelled funny after asparagus because mine does.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, that's...
And I've not gone around and smelled.
That's exactly it. Yeah. You've got to start smelling other people's urine, Tom, and find out the answer.
So it does and it doesn't, depending on something that we don't know.
That's right. It does or it doesn't. And you know what? Eat it, and then you'll find out.
If you have a myth that's causing you quite a stink, just send it to the show and have us bust it, or at least provide you with a nose plug. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Blackfoot, Idaho. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I have a question for Zorba. I have an offensive body odor that appears at times right as I get out of the shower. And I use a regular deodorant soap, washcloth, scrub the whole area around my armpits, and think I'm clean, and I get out, and within a minute or two, maybe while I'm drying off, I notice this odor again, and it's driving me crazy.
How long does it last for?
Kind of throughout the day. Of course, I notice it when I change it in the evening into my pajamas or whatever, you know.
Sure. Now, what kind of soap are you using?
I believe right now I'm using Safeguard.
Safeguard, which is a deodorant soap, usually excellent for getting rid of it. Safeguard, Lifebuoy, Irish Spring, they can dry the skin, but those deodorant soaps can be good for that. You've noticed this has been going on how many years or how many months in your life?
Oh, maybe about 6 months now.
About 6 months. Change in house or anything? You haven't changed water, gone to a different house using well water that might have sulfur in it at all?
No, but I am taking a pill for water that contains sulfur. And
how long have you been on it?
A little over 6 months. And when I was in college, I the doctor gave me a sulfur pill. Of course, that was a half century ago. But I did notice it caused horrible itching. So when this one that I was to take two times a day, I started itching. I cut back to one a day.
I would call your doctor and get on a different medicine. That would be my first thing. You've been on it for 6 months, so we've got a little temporal explanation there. It might be that when you're dry, you're actually smelling yourself, and you might have some side effects from the pill. There are a lot of other pills that can be useful versus a sulfa pill that you're taking. And I think I'd call the doctor and I'd switch medicines and see whether or not it disappears. You know, medicines have side effects. We don't understand all of them. We just understand the ones that people report. So good luck, and let us know if I solved the mystery.
I will. This is furosemide.
Furosemide.
That's it.
Well, that's a pill. That's a water pill. That's a diuretic. I'd go to a different pill and just see whether or not this is really doing what you're, you know, what is causing that. I would just change that and see what happens. If it is, we're home free. And if not, call us back.
Okay. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. And before we split for the week, Zorba, let's take this quick note about famous sayings from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox from a listener known as Miss Bliss. I'm not sure if it's the popular teacher from the great TV show Saved by the Bell. Miss Bliss writes, I heard you mention the choice of six of one, half dozen of the other as Hobson's choice. My ears perked up as I wondered who Hobson was. Lo and behold, a quick search to the reference gave me the answer and a conflict. It appears that you were unknowingly referring to Morton's fork, not a Hobson's choice.
Oh, gosh.
Hobson's choice originates from England, where in the 1500s, Hobson offered his livery customers a take-it-or-leave-it choice. You can take the horse by the door or none at all. Offering equal alternatives, six of one, half dozen of the other, or glass half empty, half full, appears to have originated in 1487 with English tax collector John Morton, Lord Chancellor to Henry VII. He offered a two-pronged solution to a taxation problem, each being equal, as a rock and a hard place, or ominously, the devil and the deep blue sea. So, Zorba, it seems you got stuck between a fork and a Hobson's choice.
I clearly have, you know. You know, I'll tell you the real problem with all this. It's the internet. I mean, before that, you could come up with things and people would have to go to the encyclopedia, go to the library, go to the bookstore and come up with an answer. Now all they do is put in Hobson's choice and it gives them the answer. And you know what? I forgot that Hobson was that. So thank you for setting us straight on Morton.
The other problem is, this is public radio that we have.
That's right. They're too intelligent.
If we were doing this on some other
station, you know something?
We'd never
get... That's right. That's right.
Well, we love hearing from you. Send your thoughts to the show in an email too.
Zorba@WPR.org.
That's it for now. See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org, or if you can find us on Facebook.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Zach Morris and A.C. Slater, otherwise known as Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, are the two Bayside alums in charge of this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0505Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.